Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the city of the future? One out of every two human beings on the planet now lives in an urban area. But while we might first think of well-planned, orderly places like London, New York, even Fort Worth and Dallas, for that matter, the truth is that most of the world's city dwellers live in sprawling ad hoc metropolitan areas like Mumbai, Cairo, and Shanghai. My guest today believes the ultimate representation of that sort of new model city exists here in North America. It is Mexico City. When David Lita first experienced Mexico City during an overnight layover in 1987, he approached his short stay with all the common trepidations. He'd heard about the crime, the crowding, the chaos. Despite that, he fell in love with the culture and within 3 years had moved to Mexico's capital to stay. He writes about all the things that fascinate, alarm, and inspire him in his new book, First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I'm delighted with your interest in the book.
Well, you write about Mexico as this place that has sort of survived and, in fact, thrived on the brink of disaster for 500 years. What is it that makes this the city that represents the 21st century?
It's a good question. But, you know, you alluded to it in your introduction. More than half the people in the world live in big cities, and most of those people live in these huge, chaotic cities that grew by leaps and bounds, even monstrously, in the last few decades. Mexico City saw its population increase from 3 million to 20 million in between, say, 1950 and 1990. I believe that because it is geographically and culturally the closest city of those, the closest of those cities to us in the United States. You know, it's a Catholic city and a Latino city, so it's the closest to our culture. I believe if you understand what's going on in Mexico City, you understand what's going on in a lot of the world. And if you understand how people live in Mexico City, you understand how perhaps most of the people in the world live.
I want to talk for just a moment about terms, and you have three separate chapters in the book that provide sort of lexicography.
Yes.
There's a term that many Mexicans would consider somewhat insulting for Mexico City residents, but it's sort of morphing, and that word is chilango.
Yes, chilango, for the longest time, was a despective, insulting term which referred to people who live in Mexico City. And Mexico City has roughly the same relation to the rest of Mexico as New York does to the United States or Paris to France. Most of the people who live in the rest of the country consider those who live in the capital to be arrogant and know-it-all and boorish and ill-mannered. So in any case, for the longest time, chilango, this term which means a resident of Mexico City, was considered an insult. But today, particularly with the younger generations, they've co-opted that word and use it proudly as a point of pride to say, yes, I'm a chilango, and what of it?
And does the idea work the other way? I know that you're in two of these cities. You're a New Yorker originally. Do chilangos look at the rest of Mexico with a sort of disdain?
That's an interesting question. I would say, you know, there's 20 million people in Mexico City, and I hate to generalize about all of them, but, you know, some of them do absolutely fulfill the stereotype, whereas others, I think, are very respectful of the culture of the rest of Mexico. I mean, I have been in restaurants in other parts of Mexico and seen people ordering around the waitresses, and their kids are ill-mannered, and they're running around the table, and I know exactly from their accents and the way they're behaving that they're from Mexico City. On the other hand, I've been, you know, in the opposite situation where, you know, I've been to Oaxaca and, you know, places with a rich history in the Mexican provinces. And the people who know most about the archaeology and history and culture of these places are also from Mexico City. So you get everything.
You had done a lot of traveling already in Mexico, but sort of avoided the DF deliberately.
Absolutely, Chris. I mean, you know, as long as I'm conscious of Mexico City, and, you know, probably way before then, it's had the worst reputation in the world. You know, before I went there, I'd heard about the crime, the overpopulation, the terrible pollution, the poverty. And I, you know, when I went to Mexico as a tourist, I avoided it. But, you know, I got there. I was traveling in Mexico in one trip, and it didn't make sense for me to avoid it. I mean, to get from one place to another, the most logical thing was to spend a night in Mexico City. And in that night and the following day, I fell in love with it. You know, you hear all about how terrible it is. And, you know, some of those problems exist. I think some of them are exaggerated. But at the same time, it turns out to be a very livable and, in many ways, very civilized city. In Mexico City, when you walk into an elevator, the other people in the elevator say good morning to you. In Mexico City, people hold doors open for each other. In Mexico City, you say at a party, if a man is introduced to a woman, they exchange a kiss on the cheek. When I go into some of my favorite cantinas, the waiters shake my hand. You know, I think it's a very livable place in many ways.
Mm-hmm. It is approaching 600 square miles because it just sort of keeps growing out. Can you talk about what that area encompasses?
That's when Mexico City, when I say that it grew from 3 million to 20 million in the space of some 40 years, precisely as you mentioned, it grew horizontally, engulfing and swallowing other cities, towns, municipalities. And, you know, that creates a lot of complications. First of all, getting around from one place to another can be a challenge. It is often an adventure and sometimes even a nightmare because the traffic can be terrible. But another complication, for example, in all that area of the 600 square miles, there are 85,000 streets. 850 of them are called Juárez. Now, Juárez was, you know, a very important statesman in Mexican history. Each of those little towns and villages and municipalities had its own Juárez street. So as the city grows, the number of Juárez streets also grows exponentially. So you have to know which neighborhood you're going to if you tell the cab driver, take me to Calle Juárez.
And you write that even the concept of near and far and how long things are going to take is entirely relative based on social class and then how you're going to get around.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I have a friend who appeared on a television program. You know, it was a political a show about politics, and, you know, they get talking heads and, you know, very smart people to give their opinions on the state of affairs. Anyway, he arrived, he did the program, and when they were finished, one of the assistants asked if she could take him to the parking lot where he'd left his car, and he said, well, I didn't come by car. And she said, oh, did you come by helicopter? Because it turned out that they had a landing strip in the roof of the building. And he said, actually, no, I came by subway, which came as a total shock to the assistant, who was not used to people arriving to participate in that show in public transportation.
Huh. And there is a real difference between sort of haves and have-nots, even in the way they approach spending. You talk about the fancy stores. You can now get a Louis Vuitton bag, or you can shop for Gucci or Cartier in Mexico City. But people who have old money only buy sort of last-minute things there.
Yes. One of the chapters in my book is about shopping, and it encompasses, you know, the sort of lowest level street market where they're selling spoons that look like they were bent by Uri Geller and broken bottles and dolls, you know, that have one eye and one arm, up to El Palacio de Hierro, which is the most exclusive department store. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, one of the least savory aspects of life in Mexico City is how badly the money is distributed. The richest man in the world lives in Mexico City. He's worth about $70 billion.
Carlos Slim.
Some days he's only the second richest man in the world when fluctuations in the stock market edge him out. But half the population lives at the poverty level. And so, you know, about 15% live below the poverty level. So, yes, you've got every aspect of this is played out in terms of shopping. There is a street called Presidente Masaryk in a fashionable area called Polanco, in which you have any high-end boutique that you can imagine. Cartier, Louis Vuitton, Max Mara. I don't even know the names of all the designers, to be frank, but I don't remember them. But anything that you can find At you know, whatever the most luxurious part of Dallas is, you'll find the same stores represented on Masaryk. But it turns out that at the Louis Vuitton boutique, for example, principally the customers buy a handbag at the last minute because they need it for a party or a pair of shoes or something like that. When they really want to go and do serious shopping, they'll get on a plane and go to New York or Paris. San Antonio, I don't know about Dallas, but I know that San Antonio is a big shopping destination for people from Mexico City. They have packages that leave you, it's airfare and hotel included. The hotel is in around the corner from a very famous shopping center in San Antonio called La Galleria. So anyway, you get people buying stuff, but, you know, last minute parties, things like that. But the people who spend their most money in boutiques like Louis Vuitton and Cartier in Mexico City supposedly are drug dealers and politicians.
Because the cachet is different somehow?
Well, they don't have that culture of going to Paris to buy their clothes the way, you know, some well-heeled person with old money in Mexico City might have that culture. A drug dealer, you know, has presumably made his money more recently and you know, might feel intimidated about going to Paris to go shopping, but he will happily bring his girlfriend to the boutique on the Presidente Masaryk to get her some new outfits.
Are people with drug money treated in any different way than any other wealthy customer would be? I would imagine some people know sort of where the money comes from when they walk into a store.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody walks into Louis Vuitton and buys, you know, a $10,000 handbag with cash, well, there are a few scenarios that could be going on. One, you know, the girl for whom he's buying that handbag might not be his wife and he doesn't want a record of the purchase. He might be someone who has a cash business, you know, the Central de Abastos, which is the largest food market in the world, also in Mexico City, that's a cash business. But, you know, he's very likely a drug dealer or a corrupt politician because they've got a lot of cash floating around that is burning a hole in their pocket.
David Lida is my guest. His book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. You have a great profile of these open-air markets, which I would have assumed would be the least expensive option for people who want to buy things, but that's not always the case.
No, it really there is a slightly socialist tint to those open-air markets. You know, I live in a middle-class neighborhood in Mexico City, and, you know, the prices are fairly high. I mean, they're not that different. What I pay for fruits and vegetables in Mexico City is not that different from what you pay in Dallas. But if I were to live in a poorer neighborhood, I would pay less money, not substantially less money. I mean, the sad reality is that a lot of people simply do without fruits and vegetables in Mexico City, and they have a subsistence diet of tortillas, beans, rice, you know, eggs, things of that sort.
David Lida is my guest. We will continue our conversation with him in just a moment. The book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Lita is my guest. He's a journalist whose new book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. You can join us by sending email to think at KERA.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. How would you define the role, David, of the formal versus informal economy for Mexico City residents?
It's a really good question, Chris. Can you do all the interviews? Because these really are good questions. Roughly half the people who live in Mexico City live from the informal economy. Most of them sell things on the street. Mostly it's food, but they might sell newspapers. They might sell watches. I've seen people selling live rabbits. I've seen people selling, you know, chiclets and homemade bread and you know, anything you can imagine. But also, for example, maids, people who clean other people's apartments and houses, people who clean industrial buildings, people who clean government buildings. People who clean public buildings in general do not pay taxes and are not covered by any insurance or benefits. So this is roughly half of the population. Which is an extraordinary percentage, and they are in a way my heroes in Mexico City, because they work so hard and just through the sweat of their brows are often, or at least sometimes, able to claw their way out of poverty and make a better life for their children. I mean, in my book, I mention a couple of people who, for the past, now it's nearly 30 years, have been selling food from buckets, you know, at a street corner fairly near where I live. It's excellent food. You know, the woman gets up at, you know, about 4 in the morning and puts that food together, and there's always a crowd around their little stand because the food is so good. And, you know, at least one of their kids is getting a college education. Another fellow I know, he's in the book too, Jeronimo, who sells newspapers on a street corner, has managed through dint of savings. Now, Jeronimo works 7 days a week. He has, you know, door-to-door, 12-hour day. He's always got a smile on his face. He bounces from car to car. I've seen him he's so fast that I've seen him at a single stoplight move 4 or 5 newspapers. By dint of hard work, he's got no money in his family, but there's a little bit of land. He's already built a house on that land, and he's building a mini-mart, and when construction is finished in 2 or 3 years, he's going to retire to work that mini-mart, and he says he'll leave Mexico City and never return again.
And for many people, the goal really is to sort of get out of that inner city environment and own their little patch of land. Is that it?
Yes, that is the dream. I mean, it's not for everybody. I mean, for some people, you know, who are from Mexico City, I mean, Jeronimo, the guy who sells newspapers, is from Maxcanu, which is a tiny town it's not that tiny. It's a small town in the Yucatan in southern Mexico. But other people who are from Mexico City, their dream would be to open a small business. Maybe it's a taco stand. Maybe it's the most modest kind of business at all. But you're much more likely to earn a decent living with your own small, modest business than you are from working a salary job. Salaries are pitiably low in Mexico City, unfortunately. It's it's an expensive city to live in compared to, you know, many places in the world, and certainly compared to what people earn.
Does that informal economic base that is, you know, sort of under the wire of any kind of taxation, does that contribute to the fact that there is no urban planning, or is that really a cultural phenomenon?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think probably the answer is both. I think in some ways, the problem about urban planning in Mexico is that the city grew so quickly and so widely that, between the 1960s, roughly, and the end of the 1980s, people from small towns, principally in the rural areas of Mexico, were streaming into Mexico City at a rate of something like 2,000 a day. And they would build these shanty towns on what were the outskirts. But, of course, the outskirts kept getting farther and farther out, and farther away from the center of the city.
They were squatters for the most part.
Exactly. And, you know, in time, these communities became established places with their, you know, with electrical, you know, electrical wiring and garbage collection and social services and their own, you know, political infrastructure. But, you know, at the time, they were shanty towns. So this happened too quickly for any kind of formal political or social infrastructure to keep up with it. It isn't necessarily something that I would fault the people, the government of Mexico City, for not having good urban planning. It just happened too fast. The growth happened too fast for planning to occur.
David Lida is my guest. His new book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Gina in Dallas. Hi, Gina.
Hello.
Hi, Gina.
I'm from Mexico City, and I grew up there until
Mucho gusto, igualmente.
I grew up in Mexico City until I was 15, and then my parents moved us to Chicago. So I've lived in big cities almost all my life. Mexico City, to me, is a place where you either love it or you hate it.
I haven't met anybody
who is in the middle. But I wanted to, I love it, obviously.
Oh,
but
okay.
I wanted to ask you just one quick question. Could you talk a little bit about the environmental issues that are facing Mexico in relation to your urban planning?
It's another excellent question, Gina. I mean, the good news, for example, is that the pollution situation is much better today than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. There are two reasons for that. Number one, all the new cars in Mexico City since 1991 have had catalytic converters, so they are less contaminating. And there used to be, Mexico City is built into a valley. There used to be 35,000 factories ringing the valley, and they contaminated the air, you know, in a terribly toxic way. But in the 90s, Mexico City moved principally from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. So most of those factories closed down. I'm not saying it's a great situation, but it's much better than it was before.
They've essentially lost those manufacturing jobs to globalization.
Excuse me?
They've lost a lot of those manufacturing jobs to globalization.
They have, but I think it will be very interesting to see. I mean, in the future, with high oil prices, you know, people were going to do manufacturing. United States companies and multinationals were going to China for cheaper labor, and it is cheaper than it is in Mexico. Shipping charges were low when gas prices were low. But now, with gas prices getting higher, I believe some of that manufacturing work will return to Mexico.
How? Go ahead.
But the thing that I want to say, like the bad news, for example, in terms of ecology, you know, there are a lot of green efforts by the new mayor, Marcelo Ebrard, but only something like 6% of the garbage in Mexico City is recycled. They have a terrible system of water treatment and water collection. It rains reliably every day for something like 5 months a year, and they do not collect and treat that water. That water gets trapped in clogged drains, and in the poor sections of the city, there's flooding every year during rainy season. So I think while it is not yet at the level of an ecological disaster, I don't think enough is being done for it to be in the place where it should be.
Would you talk for a minute about what you call the Mexican brush off? Because when you write about this, I'm thinking it must be in some ways a maddening place to work as a journalist.
It's a challenge. I mean, instead of looking at the negative, I try to see the glasses half full. It is very common if you call the office of a Mexican bureaucrat and say, you know, I'd like to speak to Mr. So-and-so, who's the person in charge of press relations. I'm working for this paper, this magazine, and I need a few questions answered. The person who answers the phone will say, well, he's not in. Okay, fine. When will he be back? You know, gee, I'm really not sure. I can't tell you. Do you have any idea when he'll be back? No, you know, he really hasn't told us. Well, is there anybody there who knows when he's going to come back? It seems to me that, by and large, Mexican bureaucrats make it a point to never be near to their telephones and to make sure that they never tell anybody where they are or when they will return.
Mm-hmm. But you found that nobody ever tells you no. Either they just don't give you a definitive yes.
No, you're absolutely right. That no is I think many Mexicans are physiologically incapable of saying the word no. So the way that people speak in Mexico City, particularly in the bureaucratic class, is a code, and you have to learn what that code is. People just hate to say no, and if they're trying to give you the brush, or if there might be certain ways that will tip you off, that they'll say, you know, it's a wonderful idea, and I have to speak to my colleagues and think about it. Or, in principle, yes, I want to go ahead with this project with you. Let me make a study of it. Or, you know, those will give you the idea that they're saying no.
Uh-huh.
But to actually say the word no is very, very difficult for a Mexican.
What did it take for you as a journalist to learn the city and its culture to the extent that you could actually effectively cover what was going on there?
Well, the worst thing that one Mexican writer can say about another Mexican writer is escribe con las patas. He writes with his feet. I actually wrote my book with my feet. I just got out. I went to all the neighborhoods that people told me, oh, don't go there, it's dangerous, or you'll never come out alive. I went everywhere, and I just sort of hung out and talked to people and found people. You know, I'd like to say that this book, although I think I cover the most important issues that are going on in Mexico City, crime, food, sex, drink, globalization, inequality, I try to tell those stories through the eyes of the people who live there, through their stories and their experiences. It's not a book that's all about, you know, data, facts, figures, numbers. It's a book about people. What has most impressed me about Mexico City is the resilience and strength of the people. They survive and sometimes thrive despite enormous obstacles. And I found out about Mexico City and feel that I was capable of doing this book because I just spent a lot of time in the street. I wore out a lot of shoe leather. Not every reporter does that. Unfortunately, a lot of reporters, given the exigencies of their jobs, they're confined to covering press releases, press conferences. They most of their sources are either politicians or academics or PR people. I didn't do much of that. I just got out on the street and talked to people. Stayed out late at night sometimes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Journalist David Lida is my guest. His book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century.
Chris, if you don't mind, I would like to mention, if it's okay,
sure,
that I've got a website that I think documents some funny, quirky, unexpected elements of Mexico City. People can find, you know, can see that and also find out more about the book if they're interested. It would be www.davidlida.com or www.firststopinthenewworld.com.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for allowing me to mention it.
Next on the line, we have John in Frisco. Hi, John.
John?
Hi, John. Are you with us? Okay, we lost John. That's okay. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I was very impressed that you chose to write about Walmart, and you sort of go into a little bit of an explanation about this. There are a lot of people who sort of get to Mexico City or Mexico in general, and they long for what it used to be with the mom-and-pop stores, and
yeah,
they're sort of bothered by the idea that these big mega-businesses are coming in and changing the way people do things.
Most of the people who are disturbed by that are foreigners who have this very romantic idea of what Mexico used to be, where, in fact, for most Mexicans, Mexico used to be an impoverished place with a lot of political inequality and problems. And they're very happy that Walmart has come into Mexico City and expanded. There's quite a number of Walmart stores there now, as well as Starbucks and you know, other examples of what some benighted people might call first world hegemony. You don't have to go to a Walmart if you don't want to. But for a lot of people in Mexico City, it's a blessing that they're there. They offer you a lot of different choices at low prices. The problem about Walmart in Mexico City is, you know, similar to the problems about Walmart everywhere. The employees are not given a great deal. Their wages, while better than the minimum wage, are not that high. They have no collective bargaining. I have the story of a guy who spoke at a conference, a Walmart employee, with a bag over his head because he didn't want to be identified, and talked about a colleague of his, a young woman, 19 or 20 years old, pregnant, who was made to move around boxes of fruit that weighed 50 and 60 pounds. And when she asked for a transfer, reluctantly they moved her to the bakery, where she was moving around tubs of lard that were 30 and 40 pounds. And, you know, she ended up giving birth prematurely. But for the consumer, I think there's no doubt that Walmart is a great thing for Mexico City.
Did you struggle yourself at any point with the sort of romantic longing for what old Mexico was supposed to have been?
That's a good question. Maybe early on when I got there, yeah, I remember, this is, you know, my first more naive years in Mexico City. I remember, this doesn't have to do with Mexico City. It has to do with Acapulco, which is the closest beach to Mexico City, and where a lot of people from Mexico City go on weekends if they have a chance. And I went with some friends, you know, who they wanted to go to a discotheque, which was a very kind of 70s-style discotheque with a mirror bowl and smoke machines and things like that. And we were divided into two camps, this group of friends and I. You know, some of us wanted to go to a more old-fashioned, traditional, down-and-dirty cantina, which is a bar, and they wanted to go to the discotheque. But they sustained that the discotheque was just as much a part of Mexico as the cantina, and I have come to believe that, just as Walmart is just as much a part of Mexico City as an old-fashioned street market.
David Lida is my guest. We're talking about his book, First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. We'll be back in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist David Lida, whose new book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You write at one point, David, of course it is a thorny proposition to try to make sense of the sexuality of 20 million people, but it's even trickier when that sexuality is baroque, misleading, confusing, surprising, and secretive.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin. One of the longest chapters, Balzac, the French novelist, said that all great books are about money and sex. And I can't say that mine is a great book, but I can say there's a lot of money and a lot of sex in it. One of the longest chapters in the book tries to give an overview of what Mexican sexuality is like, at least in the city. And there are shorter chapters about, I mean, there's a profile of a woman of a certain age who is a showgirl in the last cabaret in Mexico City. There's another short chapter about a young man who wants to build a porno empire. And there's another short chapter about one of my favorite people in Mexico City, whose name is Patti. She is what is known as a fichera. Ficheras are women who, they're kind of like dance hall girls. There's certain bars where men go to sort of drown their sorrows, and they buy a woman's company. They're not prostitutes, although some might, you know, be willing to work something out with their clients.
They're almost like geishas in some way.
Well, I would say they were closer to geishas than to prostitutes, because most men go there to, they buy these women drinks, that, you know, the women get a commission on the drinks, and they give the women tips, and they have conversation with them. They flirt with them, you know, and they know they're not going to get rejected. And they tell all their troubles to these women, and they dance with them to the tunes on the jukebox. And Patti, you know, a lot of guys go to these places because they want to tell all their troubles to someone who won't judge them. I also go to visit Patti when I'm troubled, but I don't tell her what my problems are. I just ask her to just start talking because she's like Scheherazade. She has 1,001 stories. And listening to her tell the story. I mean, she's a really interesting woman. I have never asked how old she is, but she's been a fichera since 1985, which was the year that there was a terrible earthquake in Mexico City. And in that same year, unfortunately, her husband came down with multiple sclerosis, a disease that she refers to as European. And she was a waitress at a coffee shop owned by Carlos Slim. And she was not going to be able to make it on that salary to take care of herself, her two children, and her husband. So she became a fichera. And, you know, you can imagine in 23 years, she's built up a huge file of stories of, you know, some of her clients, including one man who would take her out from the bar to a hotel, buy a bunch of roses at the corner, and have her strip and eat the rose petals. There was no sex involved. That was all he wanted.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. What is it like for gays and lesbians in Mexico City?
Another good question. Really, Chris, I wish you were doing all the interviews. Gays and lesbians in Mexico City, in general terms, it's a better time than ever for them. I think I can say that pretty uncategorically. The young gays and lesbians, I'm talking about people who are under 30 and particularly under 25, have had a much easier time of it in the last few years than their counterparts who are, say, 35 and up. On the one hand, Mexico City has always been one of the places in the country that is most tolerant toward homosexuality and lesbianism. But on the other hand, you know, there were always raids of gay bars. You know, everybody would get taken to jail. There were shakedowns and threats. You know, policemen saying things like, you know, if you don't give me money, I'll tell them at your family or at your workplace. But you know, most of the young gays and lesbians that I talk to, who are, you know, 25, say, had a fairly easy time coming out to their families and even in the workplace, and you know, live openly. Or fairly, you know, it's not openly in the sense of the United States where people march down the street, you know, carrying a flag, but openly in the sense that they don't hide it. They might not talk about it out loud, but they don't have to hide it. And this level of acceptance is very new in Mexico City. Also, another thing in Mexico City, last year they passed a law, a cohabitation law, that gives couples of the same sex legal status, which, you know, has happened in very few cities around the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Andrew in Richardson. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah, hi. David.
Hi, Andrew.
The show here. Wanted to relate a little bit of my experience. I lived in Mexico City from 2002 to 2006. I worked at an American school there. And it happened almost completely by accident. It was sort of a series of events that led to my wife and I, just a young couple at the time, living down there. When we returned to the United States in 2006, we had two kids with us. So we have two kids, both of whom are Mexican citizens. They have nationality there, which I could probably write a book about that process by itself.
Right.
What I wanted to talk about is, you know, I am your what you would call your typical ethnic majority American male, and to experience some of the racism that I experienced there as someone who was different, not necessarily American. You know, in the United States, we're so accustomed to so many different people. We do have racism problems like that, but at least it's an open kind of discussion. I was constantly pulled over while driving what we call DWA, driving while American, because I had a car that was from the United States. It had license plates from the United States. At one time, I was given a hard time by two policemen as I left an ATM. And almost forced to give them the money that I had just withdrawn. And those kinds of experiences to me were, you know, I'd never heard of anything like that, never experienced anything like that, because in the United States I'm a majority. And I wonder, as someone who is probably, and I haven't seen you, but I'm guessing, does not necessarily look like you fit there. What kinds of things did you experience?
This is an excellent topic, and I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, I have a whole chapter about globalization in Mexico City, and it tells the stories of five people who come from other countries that have come to seek a different life in Mexico City, including a guy who is a very fancy cocktail bartender from London, a chef from New York, a model from Brazil, and off the top of my head, I don't remember the others. I would say, yes, on the one hand, you were the victim of, you know, certain shakedowns while you were driving. I don't drive a car, so that's one way that I avoid. I don't drive a car for practical purposes because the traffic is ridiculous in Mexico City. But that has saved me, I think, certain hassles as well, you know, in terms of what Andrew's talking about. But I also think, Andrew, you have to have a certain amount of perspective. You worked, I'm assuming, at the American School?
We don't have him on the line any
okay.
longer.
Andrew had a good job just because he was American. He was able to waltz into Mexico City with a job at a salary much higher than most Mexicans earn. And I think he's not acknowledged, when he acknowledges the difficult aspects of being a foreigner in Mexico, he's not acknowledging the privilege aspects. I think the privileges of being a foreigner far outweigh the disadvantages. I mean, yes, I've heard lots of anti-gringo remarks. I do believe that Mexicans are sort of innocently racist, which is, you know, a dangerous term because how innocent can you be? But I think that Mexicans don't realize that when they use despective words like gringo, or, you know, there's one for black people, there's one for French people, there's one for Spanish people. I think they're sort of innocent in the sense that they don't realize how damaging those kind of remarks can be. But, and yes, those things are part of the fabric of life in Mexico City. At the same time, I think it is very easy for foreigners, at least foreigners from the United States, Europe, or South America, to waltz into Mexico City, Koreans as well, Japanese, and find a privileged position, a good job, a good salary, a situation that certainly most Mexicans would not very easily be able to find themselves in.
Did you ever find yourself, did you carry extra money for mordida, or just in case you were sort of stopped by a police officer?
No. I sort of walk around with whatever money I think I'm going to need that day. I was the victim of what is called a secuestro express, an express kidnapping. I was in a taxi cab. This is a long time ago, in 1996. Some goons, you know, stopped the cab, barreled inside, and basically they took my credit cards and tried to get money from ATM machines. I was lying on the floor of the cab going around in circles on the inner city highways while they tried to get this money. It was a terrible experience. And for the longest time, for years after that, I never walked around with credit cards. I just carried cash, and I figured, well, if I get hit again, you know, they'll take the money and run, and they won't have any reason to keep me prisoner. Now, yes, this was it happened in 96, and in all the years I've lived in Mexico City, and I've called it my home since 1990, that's the only bad thing that ever happened to me. I'm knocking wood as I say that. I mean, I grew up in New York, and, you know, I got mugged several times as I was growing up. So, I haven't had to take special... that was special precautions, yes, walking around without credit cards. But after, you know, years and years passed, I said, well, you know, I think I can start walking around with my credit cards again. I mean, if once in a while in a blue moon something happens to you, that's part of living in a big city. Luckily, nothing else has happened to me since.
Let's speak next to Suzanne in Dallas. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to work for a large telecom company and traveled frequently to Mexico City and was very apprehensive at first, even though I did grow up in New Mexico and have traveled to Mexico a lot. I just heard so many bad things about Mexico City with pollution and crime and everything, and I just found it to be a wonderful experience, even though it was quite a ride from the airport to downtown where our offices were. It was always a very interesting ride. I used to just love It's, you know, because there aren't tall buildings like you have in most American cities, and you'll see the dogs on people's roofs instead of in their backyards, and it was just a really great visual experience. And one time I even took my daughter when she was 14 and set her up with a concierge in the hotel while I went to meetings, and she went with a group from the hotel and toured the pyramids and the cathedrals, et cetera. And I guess I'm wondering, is it still safe for tourists in that area?
In which area?
Well, in, I guess, most of the tourist areas. Is
yeah,
still...
listen, I mean, again, these are great questions. After the sex chapter, I believe the longest chapter in the book is about crime, because most people identify Mexico City as a high-crime area. And while, you know, don't get me wrong, it is a tough town, and it's a place that one has to watch one's back, but I absolutely believe, and I think I back it up with evidence, that the perception of crime in Mexico City is far worse than the reality. Most people go about their day and their year and their life in Mexico City without being, you know, the victims of crimes or the perpetrators of crimes. You know, proportional to any other city, you know, that has a similar economy. I encourage tourists to go to Mexico City. And, you know, yeah, I think you have to use a certain amount of common sense. I wouldn't go around flashing ostentatious jewelry. I think it's best for tourists to use radio taxis rather than the taxis that they pick up on the street. I think that tourists should just take certain precautions. You know, again, yeah, I think it's a great city for a tourist in terms of culture, museums and art galleries, history. There are great restaurants, music, art, theater, film. It's the cultural offerings of Mexico City are more along the lines of, say, New York or Paris than any other city in Latin America.
David, almost every Mexican has a friend or relative or has had one who has spent time living in the United States. It's not the same for Americans. I'm wondering if you think Mexicans understand American culture better than Americans understand Mexican culture.
That's a really interesting question. You know, most of those Mexicans who've come here to the United States have had very specific, very insular kind of lives that have to do with living, you know, in a small place, probably with a lot of other Mexicans, and working very hard. I don't think that they know that much about U.S. culture in general. They think they know a lot about U.S. culture, but I don't think it necessarily is true.
David Lita's newest book is called First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. His website is davidlita.com. David, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me the time and the space to talk about the book. You had great questions, Chris. You're a terrific interviewer.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.